throb of Orin's internal jugular vein. Orin's face changed a little. Behind him, under the blankets, the non-Swiss woman lay very calmly and patiently on her side, breathing silently into the portable O2 mask with canister from the purse beside her, one hand in the purse on the Schmeisser GBF miniature machine pistol. "I miss TV," Orin said, looking back down. He no longer smiled coolly.
"The former television of commercial broadcast?"
"I do."
"Raison, in several words or less, please. For the box after raison,"
displaying the board. "Oh, man." Orin looked back up and away, at what seemed to be nothing, feeling at his jaw around the retromandibular's much tinier and more vulnerable throb. "Some of this may sound stupid. I miss commercials that were louder than the programs. I miss the phrases, 'Order before midnight tonight,' and 'Save up to 50% and more.' I miss being told things were filmed before a live studio audience. I miss late-night anthems, and shots of flags and fighter jets, and leathery-faced Indian chiefs crying at litter. I miss sermonette and evensong, and test patterns, and being told how many megahertz something's transmitter was broadcasting at." He felt his face. "I miss sneering at something I love. How we used to love to gather in the checkered-tiled kitchen in front of the old boxy cathode ray Sony, whose reception was sensitive to airplanes, and sneer at the commercial vapidity of broadcast stuff."
"Vapidity," pretending to notate.
"I miss stuff so low denominator I could watch and know in advance what people were going to say."
"Emotions of mastery, and control, and superiority, and pleasure."
"You can say that again, boy. I miss summer reruns. I miss reruns hastily inserted to fill the intervals of writer strikes, actors' guild strikes. I miss Jeannie, Samantha, Sam and Diane, Gilligan, Hawkeye, Hazel, Jed, all the syndicated airwave haunters, you know. I miss seeing the same things over and over again." There were two muffled sneezes from the bed behind him, and the handicapped man didn't even acknowledge, pretending to write, brushing his string ties dangle away again and again as he wrote. Orin tried not to imagine the topography of the sheets the subject had sneezed into. He no longer cared about the ruse. He did feel tender somehow toward him. The man tended to look up at him like people with legs look up at buildings and planes.
"You can, of course, view entertainments again and again without surcease, on tele-entertainment discs of storage and retrieval."
Orin's way of looking up, as he remembered, was nothing like the seated guy's way of looking up. "But not the same. The choice, see? It ruins it somehow. With television, you were subjected to repetition. The familiarity was inflicted. Different now."
"Inflicted?"
"I don't think I exactly know," Orin said, suddenly, dimly stunned and sad inside. The terrible sense, as in dreams, of something vital you've forgotten to do. The inclined head's bald spot was freckled and tan. "Is there a next item?"
"Things to tell me you do not miss."
"For symmetry."
"Balance of opinion."
Orin smiled. "Plus or minus?"
"Just so," the man said.
Orin resisted an urge to lay his hand tenderly over the arc of the disabled man's skull. "Well, how much time do we have here?" The skyscraper gawking aspect was only when the man's gaze went higher than Orin's neck. They were not shy or indirect, or even the eyes of someone in any way disabled, was what struck Orin later as odd. Besides the Swiss accent, the absence of a signature ruse, the subject's patience with the wait, and the absence of gasping when O pulled the covers abruptly back later. The man had looked up at Orin and flicked his eyes slightly past him, at the room behind with pantyless floor and humped covers. Orin was meant to see the glance past him.
"Can return at the latter time which we specify. You are, comment dit, engaged?"
Orin's smile wasn't as cool as he thought, as he told the seated figure that that was a matter of opinion. As at all DSAS-certified halfway facilities, Innenhouse's resident curfew is 2330 hours. From 2300 to 2330, the staffer on night duty has to do head counts and sit around like somebody's mom waiting for different residents to come in. There's always ones that always like to cut it close and play with the idea of getting discharged for something picayune, so it won't be their fault. Tonight, Planette H and the deeply whacked out Yolanda W come back in from Footprints around 2315 in purple skirts and purple lipstick and ironed hair, tottering on heels and telling each other what a wicked time they just had. Esther Thrale undulates in a false fox jacket at 2320 as usual, even though she has to be up at like 0430 for the breakfast shift at the Provident Nursing Home, and sometimes eats breakfast with Gately, both of their faces nodding down perilously close to their frosted flakes. Chandler Foss and the spectrally thin April Cordelieu come in from someplace with postures and expressions that arouse comments and force Gately to log a possible issue about an in-house relationship. Gately has to bid goodnight to two craggy-faced brunette ex-residents who've been planted on the couch all night talking cults. Emil Minty and Nell Gunther and sometimes Gavin Dial, who Gately did 3 weeks of a municipal bit with once at Concord Farm, make a nightly point of going to smoke outside on the front porch and coming in only after Gately says twice he's got to lock the door, just as some limp, rebellious gesture. Tonight they're closely followed by a mustacheless Lentz, who sort of oozes through the door just as Gately's going through his keys to get the key to lock it, and kind of brushes by and goes up to the three men without a word, which he's been doing a lot lately, which Gately has to log. Plus the fact that it's now after 2330, and he can't account for either the semi-new girl, Amy J., or, more upsetting, Bruce Green. Then Green knocks at the front door at 2336. Gately has to log the exact time, and then it's his call whether to unlock the door. After curfew, staff doesn't have to unlock the door. Many a bad news resident gets effectively bounced this way. Gately lets him in. Green's never come close to missing curfew before and looks god-awful. Skin potato white and eyes vacant. And a big quiet kid is one thing. But Green looks at the floor of Pat's office like it's a loved one, while Gately gives him the required ass-chewing. And Green takes the standard dreaded week's full house restriction in such a vacantly hangdog way, and is so lamely vague when Gately asks, does he want to tell him where he's been at, and why he couldn't make 2330, and whether there's anything that's an issue that he might want to share with staff? So unresponsive that Gately feels like he has no choice but to pull an immediate spot urine on Green, which Gately hates doing not only because he plays cribbage with Green and feels like he's taken Green under the old Gately wing and is probably the closest thing to a sponsor the kid's got, but also because urine samples taken after Unit Number 2's clinics closed have to be stored overnight in the little staff miniature fridgelette in Don Gately's basement room, the only fridge in the house that no resident could conceivably dicky into. And Gately hates to have a warm, blue-lidded cup of somebody's goddamn urine in his fridgelette with his pears and polar seltzer, etc. Green submits to Gately's cross-armed presence in the men's head as Green produces a urine so efficiently and with so little bullshit that Gately is able to take the lidded cup between gloved thumb and finger and get it downstairs and tagged and logged and down in the fridgelet in time to not be late for getting the residents' cars moved, the night shift's biggest pain in the ass. But then his final head count at 2345 reminds Gately that Amy J. isn't back, and she hasn't called. And Pat has told him the decision to discharge after a missed curfew is his call. And at 2350, Gately makes the decision and has to get Treat and Belbin to go up into the five-woman room and pack the girl's stuff up in the same Irish luggage she'd brought it in Monday. And Gately has to put the trash bags on the front porch with a quick note explaining the discharge and wishing the girl good luck, and has to call Pat's answering device down in Milton and leave word of a mandatory curfew discharge at 2350 hours, so Pat can hear about it first thing in the a.m. and schedule interviews to fill the available bed ASAP. And then, with a hissed curse, Gately remembers the anti-big hanging gut sit-ups he sworn to himself to do every night before 0100 hours. And it's 23:56. And he has time to do only 20 with his huge discolored sneakers wedged under the frame of the office's black vinyl couch before it's unavoidably time to supervise moving the residents' cars around. Gately's predecessor as male live-in staff, a designer narcotics man who's now, via Massachusetts rehab, learning to repair jet engines at East Coast Aerotech, once described residents' vehicles to Gately as a continuing boil on the ass of night staff. Ennett House lets any resident with a legally registered vehicle and insurance keep their car at the house, if they want, during residency, to use for work and nightly meetings, etc. And the Enfield Marine Public Health Hospital goes along. Except, they put authorized parking for all the unit's clients out in the little street right outside the house. And since Metro Boston's serious fiscal troubles in the third year of subsidized time, there's been this hellish municipal deal where only one side of any street is legal for parking, and the legal side switches abruptly at 0100 hours, and cruisers and municipal tow trucks prowl the streets from 0001 hours on, writing $95 tickets and or towing suddenly illegally parked vehicles to a region of the South End so blasted and dangerous, no cabbie with anything to live for will even go there. So, the interval, 23:55 hours to 0:05 hours in Boston, is a time of total but not very spiritual community, with guys in skivvies and ladies in mud masks staggering out yawning into the crowded midnight streets and disabling their alarms and revving and all trying to pull out and do a U and find a parallel parking place facing the other way. There's nothing very mystifying about the fact that Metro Boston's battery and homicide rates during this 10-minute interval are the highest per diem, so that ambulances and paddy wagons are especially a prowl at this hour too, adding to the general clot and snarl. Since the EMPHH unit's catatonics and enfeebled people rarely own registered vehicles, it's generally pretty easy to find places along the little road to switch to. But it's a constant sore point between Pat Modisian and the EMPHH Board of Regents that Ennett House residents don't get to park overnight in the big off-street lot by the condemned hospital building. The lot's spaces are reserved for all the different units' professional staff, starting at 0600 hours, and EM Security got sick of staff's complaints about drug addicts, poorly maintained autos, still sitting there taking up their spots in the AM. And that security won't consider changing the little EM streetlet's nightly side switch to 2300 hours, before Ennett House's DSAS-required curfew. EM's board claims it's a municipal ordinance that they can't be expected to mess with just to accommodate one tenant, while Pat's memos keep pointing out that the Enfield Marine Hospital complex is state, not city-owned, and that Ennett House residents are the only tenants who face the nightly car-moving problem, since just about everyone else is catatonic or enfeebled, and so on. But so every PM at like 23:59, Gately has to lock up the lockers and Pat's cabinets and desk drawers and the door to the front office and put the phone console's answering machine on and personally escort all residents who own cars out post-curfew, outside, into the little nameless streetlet. And for somebody with Gately's real limited managerial skills, the headaches involved are daunting. He has to herd the vehicular residents together just inside the locked door. He has to threaten the residents he's herded together into staying together by the door while he clomps upstairs to get the one or two drivers who always forget and fall asleep before 0100. And this straggler collecting is a particular pain in the ass if the straggler's a female, because he has to unlock and press the mail coming up button by the kitchen, and the buzzer sounds more like a klaxon and wakes the edgiest female residents up with an ugly surge of adrenaline. And Gately, as he clomps up the stairs, gets roundly bitched out by all the mud-masked heads sticking out into the female hall. And he, by regulation, can't go into the sleeper's bedroom, but has to pound on the door and keep shouting out his gender, and get one of the straggler's roommates to wake her up and get her dressed and to the bedroom door. So he has to retrieve the stragglers and chew them out and threaten them with both a restriction and a possible tow, while herding them, quick walking down the staircase to join the main car owner herd as quickly as possible before the main herd can, like, disperse. They'll always disperse if he takes too long getting stragglers. They'll get distracted or hungry or need an ashtray, or just get impatient and start looking at the whole car moving after curfew thing as an imposition on their time. Their early recovery denial makes it impossible for them to imagine their own car getting towed instead of, say, somebody else's car. It's the same denial Gately can see at work in the younger BU or C students when he's driving Pat's Aventura to the food bank or Purity Supreme, when they'll fucking walk right out in the street against the light in front of the car, whose brakes are fortunately in top shape. Gately's snapped to the fact that people of a certain age and level of, like, life experience believe they're immortal. College students and alcoholics/addicts are the worst. They deep down believe they're exempt from the laws of physics and statistics that ironly govern everybody else. They'll piss and moan your ear off if somebody else fucks with the rules, but they don't deep down see themselves subject to them, the same rules. And they're constitutionally unable to learn from anybody else's experience. If some jaywalking BU student does get splattered on Commonwealth, or some house resident does get his car towed at 005, your other student's or addict's response to this will be to ponder just what imponderable difference makes it possible for that other guy to get splattered or towed, and not him, the ponderer. They never doubt the difference. They just ponder it. It's like a kind of idolatry of uniqueness. It's unvarying and kind of spirit-killing for a staffer to watch, that the only way your addict ever learns anything is the hard way. It has to happen to them to, like, upset the idolatry. Eugenio M. and Annie Parrott always recommend letting everybody get towed at least once, early on in their residency, to help make believers out of them in terms of laws and rules. But Gately, for some reason, on his night shifts, can't do it. Cannot fucking stand to have one of his people get towed as long as there's something he can do to prevent it. And then, plus, if they do get towed, there's the nail-chewing hassle of arranging their transport to the South End's municipal lot the next day, fielding calls from bosses, and supplying verification of residents' carelessness in terms of getting to work without letting the boss know that the careless employee is a resident of a halfway house, which is totally sacred private residents' private information to give out or not. Gately breaks a full-body sweat just thinking about the managerial headaches involved in a fucking tow. So he'll spend time herding and regathering and chewing the absent-minded asses of residents, who Gene M. says have such calloused asses. Still, it's a waste of Gately's time and spirit. You have to let them learn for themselves. Gately alerts Thrail and Foss and Erdetti and Henderson and Morris Hanley, and drags the new kid Tingley out of the linen closet, and Nell Gunther, who's fucking sacked out, slack-mouthed, on the couch in violation, and lets them all get coats and herds them together by the locked front door. Yolanda W. says she left personal items in Clinette's car, and can she come? Lance owns a car, but doesn't answer. Gately's yell up the stairs. Gately tells the herd to stay put, and that if anybody leaves the herd, he's going to take a personal interest in their discomfort. Gately clomps up the stairs and into the three-man room, plotting different fun ways to wake Lance up without bruises that show. Lance is not asleep, but is wearing personal stereo headphones, plus a jock strap, doing handstand push-ups up against the wall by Jeffrey Day's rack, his bottom only inches from Day's pillow, and farting in rhythm to the push-ups' downstrokes. As Day lies there in pajamas and Lone Ranger's sleep mask, hands folded over his heaving chest, lips moving soundlessly. Gailey's maybe a little rough about grabbing Lance's calf and lifting him off his hands, and using his other big hand on Lentz's hip to twirl him around upright like a drill team's rifle, but Lentz's cry is of over-ebullient greeting, not pain. But it sends both Day and Gavin Dial bolt upright in their racks, and then they curse as Lentz hits the floor. Lentz starts saying he'd let time completely get away from him and didn't know what time it was. Gailey can hear the herd down by the front door at the bottom of the stairs, stamping and chuffing and getting ready to maybe disperse. Up this close, Gately doesn't even need his staffer's eerie seventh sense to sense that Lentz is clearly wired on either Dreen's or Bing, that Lentz has been visited by the sergeant-at-arms. Lentz's right eyeball is wobbling around in its socket, and his mouth writhing in that way, and he has that Nietzschean supercharged aura of a wired individual. And all the time he's throwing on slacks and topcoat and incognitoizing wig, and getting almost pitched headfirst down the stairs by Gately, he's telling this insane, breathless whopper about his finger once getting cut off and then spontaneously regentrifying itself back on, and his mouth is writhing in that fish-on-a-gaff way distinctive of a sustained L-Dopa surge. And Gately wants to pull an immediate urine. Immediate. But meanwhile, the car's herd's edges are just starting to widen in that way that precedes distraction and dispersal. And they're angry not at Lentz for straggling, but at Gately for even bothering with him. And Lentz pantomimes the Aikido serene but deadly crane stance at Ken Erdetti. And it's 0:04 hours, and Gately can see tow trucks a-prowl way down on Comm Ave coming this way. And he jangles his keys and unlocks all three curfew locks on the front door and gets everybody out in the scrotum-tightening November cold, and out down the walk to the line of their cars in the little street, and stands there on the porch watching in just orange shirt sleeves, making sure Lentz doesn't bolt before he can pull a spot urine and extract an admission and discharge him officially. Feeling a twinge of conscience, and so looking forward to giving Lentz the administrative shoe. And Lentz jabbers nonstop to whoever's closest all the way to his duster, and everybody goes to their car. And the backwash around Gately from the open house door is hot, and people in the living room provide loud feedback on the draft from the open door. The sky overhead immense and dimensional, and the night so clear you can see stars hanging in a kind of lacteal goo. And out on the streetlet, a couple car doors are squeaking and slamming, and some people are conversing and delaying just to make staff have to stand there in shirt sleeves on the cold porch. A small, nightly, sideways, ball-busting, rebellious gesture. When Gately's eye falls on Dooney R. Glynn's specialty, disemboweled, old, dusty black VW Bug, parked with the other cars on the now illicit street side, its rear mount engine's guts on full glittered display under the little street's lights. And Glynn's upstairs in bed tonight, legitimately, prostrate, with diverticulitis, which, for insurance reasons, means Gately has to go back in and ask some resident with a driver's license to come move Glynn's VW across the street, which is humiliating because it means admitting publicly to these specimens that he, Gately, doesn't have a valid license. And the sudden heat of the living room confuses his goose pimples, and nobody in the living room will admit to have a driver's license. And it turns out the only licensed resident who's still vertical and downstairs is Bruce Green, who's in the kitchen, expressionlessly stirring a huge amount of sugar into a coffee cup with his bare, blunt finger. And Gately finds himself having to ask for managerial assistance from a kid he likes and has just bitched out and extracted urine from, which Green minimizes the humiliation of the whole thing by volunteering to help the second he hears the words Glynn and fucking car, and goes to the living room closet to get out his cheap leather jacket and fingerless gloves. But Gately now has to leave the residence outside still unsupervised for a second to go clomping upstairs to verify that it's kosher with Glynn for Bruce Green to move his car. The two-man, seniorist male's bedroom has a bunch of old AA bumper stickers on it, and a calligraphic poster saying, "Everything I've ever let go of has claw marks on it." And the answer to Gately's knock is a moan. And Glynn's little naked lady bedside lamp he brought in with him is on. He's in his rack, curled on his side, clutching his abdomen like a kicked man. McDade is illicitly sitting on Foss's rack, reading one of Foss's motorcycle magazines, and drinking Glynn's millennial fizz with stereo headphones on. And he hurriedly puts out his cigarette when Gately enters and closes the little drawer in the bedside table where Foss keeps his ashtray just like everybody else. The street outside sounds like Daytona. A drug addict is like physically unable to start a car without gunning the engine. Gately looks quickly out the west window over Glenn's rack to verify that all the unsupervised headlights going down the little street are Ewing and coming back the right way to repark. Gately's forehead is wet, and he feels the start of a greasy headache from managerial stress. Glenn's crossed eyes are glassy and feverish, and he's softly singing the lyrics to a choosy mother's song, to a tune that isn't the song's tune.
"Dune," Gately whispers.
One of the cars is coming back down the street a little fast for Gately's taste. Anything involving residents that happens on the grounds after curfew is his responsibility, the house manager's made clear.
"Dune."
It's the bottom eye, grotesquely, that rolls up at Gately.
"Done. Dune. Don Dune, the witch is dead.
Dune, I need to let Green move your car."
"Vehicle's black, Don."
"Rusey Green needs your keys so we can switch your car over, brother. It's midnight."
"My black bug. My baby. The Roach Mobile. The Dune laid his wheels. His mobility. His exposed baby. His slice of the American pie. Simonize my baby when I'm gone, Don Dune."
"Keys, Dooney."
"Take them. Take it. When you have it. One true friend. Brought me Ritz crackers and a fizz. Treat it like a roach lady. Shiny black heart mobile. Needs premium and a weekly wax."
"Dune, you gotta show me where's the keys, brother."
"And the bowl. Gotta weekly shine the pipes in the bowl. Exposed to view. With a soft cloth. The mobile roach. The bowl mobile."
The heat coming off Glenn is face tightening.
"You feel like you got a fever, Dune?"
At one point, elements of staff thought Glenn might be playing sick to get out of looking for a job after losing his menial job at Brighton Fence and Wire. All Gately knows about diverticulitis is that Pat said it's intestinal, and alcoholics can get it in recovery from impurities in bottom-shelf blends that the body's trying to expel. Glenn's had physical complaints all through his residency, but nothing like this here. His face is gray and waxy with pain, and there's a yellowish crust on his lips. Glenn's got a real severe adtorsion, and the bottom eye is rolled up at Gately with a terrible delirious glitter, the top eye rolling around like a cow's eye. Gately still cannot bring himself to feel another man's forehead. He settles for punching Glenn very lightly on the shoulder.
"You think we need to take you over to St. E's to get your intestine looked at, Dune, do you think?" "Lights, Don."
"You think you,
Because he's worrying about what if a resident comas or dies on his shift, and then feeling shame that this is his worry, the squeal of brakes and raised voices noises down out front hasn't registered on Gately right away. But Hester Thrale's unmistakable high B-flat scream does. That is, register. And now serious feet running up the stairs. Green's face in the doorway, red and round patches high on his cheeks.
"Come out!"
"The fuck's the problem out, Green?"
"Come out, Gately!"
Glenn, Soto.
"Mother!"
Gately doesn't get to even ask Green what the fuck again on the stairs because Green is down ahead out the door so fast. The damn front door's been open all this time. A watercolor of a retrieverish dog cants and then falls from the wall on the staircase from the vibrations of Gately taking two stairs down at a time. He doesn't take time to grab his coat off Pat's couch. All he's got on is a donated orange bowling shirt with the name Moose cursive stitched on the breast and Shuko Mist MPS in ghastly aqua blocks across the back. And he feels every follicle on his body hump up again as the cold encases him on the front porch and the wheelchair ramp down to the little walkway. The night is cold and glycerin clear and quite still. Very distant sounds of car horns and raised voices down on Commonwealth. Green's receding at a run off up the little streetlet into a glare of high beams that diffracts in the clouds of Gately's breath, so even as Gately walks briskly in Green's leather-smelling backwash toward a rising hubbub of curses, and Lentz's high-speed voice, and Thrale's glass-shattering cries, and Henderson and Willis talking shit angrily to somebody, and the sound of Joel V.D.'s veiled head in an upstairs window that isn't the five women rooms, shouting something down to Gately as he appears in the street. Even as he closes in, it takes a while for the scene to decoct out of the fog of his breath, and its shifting spears of color against the headlights. He passes Glynn's disemboweled and illegally parked bug. Several of the residents' cars are idling at haphazard angles of mid-U-turn in the middle of the street, and in front of them is a modified dark Montego with high beams and jack rear wheels and a turbo's carnivorous idol. Two almost Gately-sized bearded guys in loose, like, bowling-wear shirts with flowers or suns on them, and what looked like big, faggy necklaces of flowers around what would be their necks, if they had necks, turn out to be chasing Randy Lentz around this Montego car. Yet another guy with a necklace and a plaid Donegal is holding the rest of the residents at bay on the lawn of number 4 with a nasty-looking item, expertly held. Everything now slightly slows down. At the sight of an item held on his residence, there's almost a kind of mechanistic click as Gately's mind shifts into a different kind of drive. He gets very cool and clear, and his headache recedes, and his breathing slows. It's not so much that things slow as break into frames. The ruckus has aroused the old nurse in number 4 who asks for help. Her spectral figure is splayed in a nightie against an upstairs number 4 window, yelling, "Help!" Esther Thrale now has her pink nailed hands over her eyes and is screaming over and over for nobody to hurt nobody, especially her. It's the bulldog item that holds the attention. The two guys chasing Lentz around the Montego are unarmed but look coldly determined in a way Gately recognizes. They're not wearing coats either, but they don't look cold. All this appraisal's taking only seconds. It only takes time to list it. They have vaguely non-U.S. beards and are each about 4/5 Gately's size. They take turns coming around the car and running past the headlights' glare, and Gately can see they have similar froggy, lippy, pale foreign faces. Lentz is talking at the guys non-stop, mostly imprecating. They're all three going around and around the car like a cartoon. Gately's still walking up as he sees all this. It's obvious to appraisal the foreignish guys aren't real bright, because of their chasing Lentz in tandem, instead of heading around the car in opposite directions to trap him in, like, a pincer. They all three stop and start, Lentz across the car from them. Some of the at-bay residents are yelling to Lentz. Like most coke dealers, Lentz is quick on his feet, his topcoat billowing and then settling whenever he stops. Lentz's voice is non-stop. He's alternately inviting the guy to perform impossible acts and advancing Baroque arguments for how whatever they think he did, there's no way he was even in the same area code as whatever happened that they think he did. The guys keep speeding up like they want to catch Lentz just to shut him up. Ken Ordetti has his hands up and his car keys in his hand. His legs look like he's about to wet himself. Planette and the new black girl, clearly veterans at gunpoint etiquette, are prone on the lawn with their fingers laced behind their heads. Nell Gunther's assumed Lentz's old martial arts crane stance, hands twisted into flat claws, eyeing the guy's 44, which pans coolly back and forth over the residence. This smaller guy gets the most frames, the slowest. He's got on a plaid hunting cap that keeps Gately from seeing if he's foreign also. But the guy's holding the weapon in the classic weaver stance of somebody that can really shoot. Left foot slightly forward, slightly hunched, a two-handed grip with the right arm cocked, elbow out, so the item's held up high in front of the guy's face, up to his sighting eye. This is how policemen and made guys from the North End shoot. Gately knows weapons way better than sobriety still, and the item, if the guy trig pulls on some resident that resident's going down, the item's
some customized version of a U.S. 44 Bulldog Special, or maybe a Nuck or Brazilian clone, blunt and ugly and with a bore like the mouth of a cave. The stout alcoholic kid, Tingley, has both hands to his cheeks and is 100% at bay. The piece has been modified, Gately can appraise. The barrel's been vented out near the muzzle to cut your bulldog's infamous recoil. The hammer's bobbed, and the thing's got a fat magnaport or clone grip like the Metro Finest favor. This is not a weekend warrior or liquor store hold-up type item. It's one that's made real specifically for putting projectiles into people. It's not a semi-auto, but is throated for a fucking speedloader, which Gately can't see if the guy's got a speedloader under the loose floral shirt, but needs to assume the guy's got near unlimited shots with a speedloader. The North Shore Finest, on the other hand, wrap their grips in this, like, colored gauze that wicks sweat. Gately tries to recall a past associate's insufferable ammo lectures when under the influence. Your bulldog and clones can take anything from light target loads and wad cutter to Colt soft tip dum-dums and worse. He's pretty sure this thing could put him down with one round. He's not sure. Gately's never been shot, but he's seen guys shot. He feels something that is neither fear nor excitement. Joelle Van Dee is shouting stuff you can't make out, and her daddy at bay on the lawn's calling out to her to get her head out of the whole picture. Gately's been bearing down this whole brief time, both seeing his breath and hearing it, beating his arms across his chest to keep some feeling in his hands. You could almost call what he feels a kind of jolly calm. The un-American guys chase Lance and then stop across the car facing him for a second, and then get furious again and chase him. Gately guesses he ought to be grateful the third guy doesn't come over and just shoot him. Lance puts both hands on whatever part of the car he stops at, and sends language out across the car at the two guys. Lance's white wig is askew, and he's got no mustache, you can see. EM Security, normally so scrupulous with their fucking trucks at 005 hours, is nowhere around, lending weight to yet another cliché. If you ask Gately what he was feeling right this second, he'd have no idea. He's got a hand up, shading his eyes, and closes on the Montego as things further clarify. One of the guys now, you can see, has Lentz's disguise as mustache in two fingers and keeps holding it up and brandishing it at Lentz. The other guy issues stilted but colorful threats in a Canadian accent. So it emerges on Gately, it's Nux. The trio Lentz has managed to somehow enrage is Nux. Gately cops a black surge of remember Whenning, the battling little football head Quebecer he'd killed by gagging a man with a bad cold. This line of thinking is intolerable. Joelle's overhead shout to, for Christ's sake, somebody call Pat, mixes in and out of the help lady's cries. It occurs to Gately that the help lady has cried wolf for so many years that real shouts for real help are all going to be ignored. The residents all look to Gately as he crosses the street directly into the Montego's wash of light. Hester Thrale screams out, "Look out! There's an item!" The plaid hat Nook pans stiffly to sight at Gately, his elbow up around his ear. It occurs to Gately, if you fire with an item right up to your sighting eye, like that, won't you get a face full of cordite? There's a break in the circular action around the throbbing car as Lentz shouts, "Don!" with great gusto, just as the help lady shouts for help. The Nook with the item has backed up several steps to keep the residents in his peripheral vision, while he sights square on Gately, as the massive Nook holding the mustache across the car tells Gately, if he was him, he'd return to whence he came, him, to avoid the trouble. Gately nods and beams. Nooks really do pronounce the with a Z. Both the car and Lance are between Gately and the large Nooks. Lance is back to Gately. Gately stands quietly, wishing he felt different about potential trouble. Less almost jolly. Late in Gately's substance and burglary careers, when he'd felt so low about himself, he'd had sick little fantasies of saving somebody from harm, some innocent party, and getting killed in the process and getting eulogized at great length in bold-faced globe print. Now Lentz breaks away from the hood of the car and dashes Gately's way and around behind him to stand behind him, spreading his arms wide to put a hand on each of Gately's shoulders, using Don Gately like a shield. Gately's stance has this kind of weary resolution of like, you'll have to go through me. The only anxious part of him can see the log entry he'll have to make if residents come to physical grief on his shift. For a moment he could almost smell the smells of the penitentiary. Armpits, and pomade, and sour food, and cribbage board wood, and reefer and mop water. The rich piss stink of a zoo's lion house. The smell of the bars you lace your hands through and stand there, looking out. This line of thinking is intolerable. He's neither goose-pimpled nor sweating. His senses haven't been this keen in over a year. The stars in their jelly and dirty sodium lamplight, and stark white steer horns of headlights splayed at residents' different angles. Star-chalked sky, his breath, faraway horns, low trill of ATH-SCME's way to the north. Thin, keen, cold air in his wide-open nose. Motionless heads at number 5's windows. The Nook duo with flowers chasing lens come around this side and now break away from the car toward them. Now Hester Thrail, at Gately's right periphery, breaks away from the cluster and runs for it, off into the night, across the lawn and behind number 4, waving her arms and screaming. And Minty, and McDade, and Parias Carbo, and Charlotte Treat appear out of Ennett House's back door across the hedge and mill, and jostle amid the mops and old furniture on Ennett's back porch, watching. And a couple of the more mobile catatonics appear on the porch of the shed across the little street, staring at the specked op. All this flummoxing the smaller one, so he keeps swinging the item stiffly this way and that way, trying to keep way more people at potential bay. The two alien foreigners that want Lentz's map bear down slowly across the Montico's headlights toward where Lentz is holding Gately like a shield. The larger one, that's so large his luau-ish shirt won't even button all the way, holding out the mustache, adopts this overly reasonable tone that always precedes a serious-type beef. He reads Gately's bowling shirt in the headlight and says, reasonably, that Moose still has a chance to keep out of what they've got no beef with him. Them. Lentz is pouring a diuretic splatter of disclaimers and exhortations into Gately's right ear. Gately shrugs at the Nucks like he's got no choice but to be here. Green's just looking at them. It occurs to Gately, by white flag suggestion, that who gives a fuck how it'd look? He ought to hit his knees right here on the head-lit blacktop and ask for guidance on this from a higher power. But he stands there, Lentz chattering in the shadow. The fingernails of Lentz's hand on Gately's shoulder have horseshoes of dried blood in the creases between nail and finger, and there's a coppery smell off Lentz that isn't just fear. It occurs to Gately that if he'd pulled the instant spot urine he'd wanted on Lentz, this whole snafu wouldn't maybe be happening. The one Nook is holding Lentz's disguise's mustache out at them like a blade. Lentz hasn't asked the time once, notice. Then the other Nook's got his hand down at his side, and a real blade's gleam appears in that hand with the familiar snick. At the blade's sound, the situation becomes even more automatic, and Gately feels adrenaline's warmth spread through him as his subdural hardware clicks deeper into a worn, familiar, long-past track. Having no choice now not to fight, and things simplify radically, divisions collapse. Gately's just one part of something bigger he can't control. His face in the left headlight has dropped into its fight expression of ferocious good cheer. He says he's responsible for these people on these private grounds tonight, and is part of this whether he wants to be or not. And can they talk this out because he doesn't want to have to fight them? He says twice, very distinctly, that he does not want to fight them. He's no longer divided enough to think about whether this is true. His eyes are on the two men's maple leaf belt buckles, the part of the body where you can't get suckered by a feint. The guys shake their manes and say they're going to unembowel this craven batar. Here, like this Saint Christ batar killed somebody they call either Pepe or Bebe, and if Moose has any self-interest, he'll backpedal away from. There's no way it is his duty to get frapped or fropped for this sick, gutless USA batar,
in his womanly wig. Lance, apparently thinking they're Brazilian, pops his head around Gately's flank and calls them maricones, and tells them they can suck his batar, is what they can do. Gately has just a vision enough to almost wish he didn't feel such a glow of familiar warmth, a surge of almost sexual competence, as the two shriek at Lance's taunts, and split and curve in at them an arm's length apart, walking gradually faster, like unstoppable inertia, but stupidly, too close together. At 2 meters off, they charge, shedding petals and unisonly bellowing something in Canadian. It's always that everything always speeds up and slows down both. Gately's smile broadens as he's shoved slightly forward by Lance, as Lance recoils backward off him to run from the guy's shrieking charge. Gately takes the shove's momentum and body checks the enormous nook holding the mustache into the nook holding the blade, who goes down with an oof of expelled air. The first nook has hold of Gately's bowling shirt and rips it, and punches Gately in the forehead, and audibly breaks his hand, letting go of Gately to grab his hand. The punch makes Gately stop thinking, in any sort of spiritual terms at all. Gately takes the man's broken hand's arm he's holding out, and with his eyes on the ground's other nook, breaks the arm over his knee. And as the guy goes down on one knee, Gately takes the arm and pirouettes around, twisting the broken arm behind the guy's back and plants his sneaker on the guy's floral back and forces him forward so there's a sick crack, and he feels the arm come out of the socket, and there's a high, foreign scream. The nook with the blade who is down slashes Gately's calf through his jeans as the guy rolls gracefully left and starts to rise, up on one knee, knife out front, a guy that knows his knives and can't be closed with while he's got the blade up. Gately faints and takes one giant step and gets all his weight into a rocket kick that lands high up under the nook's beard's chin and audibly breaks Gately's big toe in the sneaker and sends the man curving out back into the dazzle of the high beams. And there's a metallic boom of him landing on the Montego's hood, and the click and skitter of the blade landing somewhere on the street beyond the car. Gately on one foot, holding his toe, and his slashed calf feels hot. His smile is broad but impersonal. It's impossible outside choreographed entertainment to fight two guys together at once. They'll kill you. The trick to fighting two is to make sure and put one down for long enough that he's out of the picture long enough to put the other guy down. And this first larger one, with the extreme arm trouble, is clutching himself as he rolls, trying to rise, still perversely holding the white mustache. You can tell this is a real beef because nobody's saying anything. And the sounds from everybody else have receded to the sounds stands crowds make. And Gately hops over and uses the good foot to kick the nook twice in the side of the big head, and then, without a thought in his head, moves down the guy and lines it up and drops to one knee with all his weight on the guy's groin, resulting in an indescribable sound from the guy, and a shout from JVD overhead, and a flat crack from the lawn. And Gately's punched so hard in the shoulder, he spun around on one knee and almost goes over backwards, and the shoulder goes hotly numb, which tells Gately he's gotten shot, instead of punched in the shoulder. He never got shot before. Shot in sobriety, in bold headline caps, goes across his mind's eye like a slow train, as he sees the third nook with his cap pushed back, a nook face contorted with cordite in his good stance, with elbow back up, drawing a second bead on Don's big head from number four's lawn, with the boar's lightless eye and a little pubic curl of smoke coming up from the vented muzzle. And Gately can't move, and forgets to pray. And then the boar, zagging up and away as it blooms orange, as good old Bruce Green's got the nuck from behind in a half-Nelson, with his hand in the necklace of flowers, and with the other hand is forcing the cocked elbow down and the item skyward, away from Gately's head as it blooms with that flat crack of a vented muzzle. The first thing somebody who's shot wants to do is throw up, which, by the way, the larger nook with the breeze-blocked crotch under Gately's doing all over his beard and flower necklace, and Gately's leg's thigh as Gately weaves on one knee on the guy's groin still. The lady yells for help. Now,
A meaty thwack, as Nell Gunther on the lawn leaps several twirling meters and kicks the Nook, Green's half-Nelsoning, in the face with her paratrooper boot's heel. And the guy's hat flies off and his head snaps back and hits Green's face, and there's a pop of Green's nose breaking, but he doesn't let go. And the guy slumped forward in the Parkinsonian half-bow of a guy in a quality half-Nelson, with the guy's item hand's arm still up in the air with Green's arm, like they're dancing. And good old Green doesn't even let go to hold his spurting nose, and now that the Nook's restrained, notice, here comes Lentz, barreling in, howling from the hedge's shadows, and leaping. And he tackles the Nook and Green both, and they're a royal of clothes and legs on the lawn, the item not in sight. Ken Erdetti still has his hands up. Gately, still kneeling, shot on the Nook's sickeningly softened groin. Gately hears the second Nook trying to slide himself off the hood of the Montego and hops and wobbles over. Joelle Van Dee keeps yelling something monosyllabic from what can't be her window. Don goes to the Montego's front bumper and punches the large man carefully in the kidneys with his good arm and takes him by the thick foreign hair and slides him back up the hood and begins banging his head off the Montego's windshield. He remembers how he'd stay in luxury-furnished North Shore apartments with G. Fackelman and T. Kite. And they'd gradually strip the place and sell the appointments off until they were sleeping in a totally bare apartment. Green has risen, bloody-faced, and Lance is on the lawn with his heaving topcoat covering him and the third Nook. And Clinette H. and Yolanda W. are now up and not at bay and circling them and getting solid high-heel kicks into the Nook's and sometimes, hopefully, Lentz's ribs, reciting, "Motherfucker!" and landing a kick each time they get to, "Fuck!" Gately, canted way over to the side, methodically beats his Nook's shaggy head against the windshield so hard that spidered stars are appearing in the shatterproof glass until something in the head gives with a sort of liquid crunch. Petals from the guy's necklace are all over the hood and Gately's torn shirt. Joelle Van Dee, in her terry robe and gauze veil, and still clutching a toothbrush, has climbed out onto the little balcony outside the five-woman's window, and into a skinny ailanthus beside it, and is coming down, showing about 2 meters of spectacularly undeformed thigh, shouting Gately's name by the first name, which he likes. Gately leaves the largest Nook prone on the idling hood, his head resting in a shatter-frosted, head-shaped recession in the windshield. It occurs to Ken Erdetti, looking up into the oak past his upraised hands, that this deformed, veiled girl likes Don Gately in an extracurricular way, it would seem. Gately, toe and shoulder or no, has looked strictly all business this whole time. He's projected a sort of white-collar attitude of cheery competence and sang-froid. Erdetti's found he rather likes standing there, with his hands up in a gesture of non-combatant status, while the Afro-American girls curse and kick, and Lance continues to roll around with the unconscious man hitting him and going, "There! There!" And Gately moves backward between the second fellow in the windshield and the first fellow he'd originally disarmed, his smile now as empty as a pumpkin's grin. Chandler Foss is trying on the third fellow's plaid hunting cap. There's a sound in number 4 of somebody trying to force a warped window. An Empire WDV is launched with a kind of spronging thud and whistles overhead, climbing, its warning light wrap of like Christmas lights winking red and green as Don Gately starts to come over in the direction of the lawn, and the fellow who appears to have winged him, and then veers drunkenly and changes direction, and in 3 1-foot hops, is over to the vomit-covered first Nook, the one who'd called Gately Moose and punched him in the forehead. There's the slow trundle of the green tea, and exhortations from Minty, as Gately begins stomping on the supine face of the Nook with the heel of his good foot, as if he were killing cockroaches. The guy's movable arm is waggling pathetically in the air around Gately's shoe as it rises and falls. Gately's hideous, torn orange shirt's whole right side is dark, and his right arm drips blackly and seems weirdly set in its socket. Lentz is up and adjusting his wig and brushing off. The veiled girl has hit a rough part some 3 meters up and is hanging from a limb and kicking.
her daddy staring Copernicanly up her flapping robe. The new tingly kid sits cross-legged in the grass and rocks as the black ladies continue stomping the inert nook. You can hear Emil Minty and Wade McDade exhorting Yolanda W. to use the spike heel. Charlotte Treat is reciting the Serenity Prayer over and over. Bruce Green has his head back and his finger held like a mustache under his nostrils. Hester Thrale can still be heard way off down Warren Street, receding, as Gately wobbles back from the Nook's map and sits heavily down in the little street, in shadow except for his huge head in the Nook's car's lights, sitting there with his head on his knees. Lentz and Green move in toward him, the cautious way you approach a big animal that's hurt. Joelle Van Dyne lands on her feet. The lady at the high warped window shouts for, "Help, help, 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 help!" Minty and McDade come down off the back porch finally, McDade for some reason wielding a mop. Everybody except Lentz and Minty looks unwell. Joelle runs just like a girl, her daddy notes.
256.
She gets out through the many angled cars into the street just as Gately decides to lie down. It's not like passing out, it's just a decision Gately makes, to like lie back with his knees bent and pointing up into the sky's depth, which seems to bulge and recede with a pulse in his right shoulder, which has now gone dead cold, which means there will very soon be pain, he predicts. He waves off concern with the left hand and goes, "Flesh wound," the second Joelle's bare feet and robe's hem are in view.
"Son of a fucking bitch! Flesh wound. Are you ever bleeding? Thanks for the feedback."
You can hear Henderson and Willis off in the background still going, "Fuck!"
"I think you can tell them he's probably subdued,"
Gately pointing off in what he thinks is number four's lawn's direction. His lying flat gives him a double chin, he can feel, and pulls his big face into a smile. His big present fear is throwing up in front of and maybe partly on Joelle V.D., whose calves, he's noted. Now Lentz's lizard skin loafers with grass stains at the toes. "Don, what can I say?" Gately struggles to sit back up.
"You got fucking armed nooks wanting your ass, too?"
Revealing a kind of blackly kimono-ish thing under, Joelle has taken off the terry robe and folds the robe into a kind of trapezoidal pad and is kneeling over Gately's shoulder, straddling his arm, pressing down on the pad with the heels of her hands.
"Owie. Lentz, he's really bleeding bad here."
"I'm groping to even know what to begin to say, Don."
"You owe me urine, Lentz."
"I think there's two of them, like, desisted."
Wade McDee's unlaced high tops, his voice breathy with awe.
"He's bleeding really bad," I said. "You mean deceased.
There's one of their shoes and one of them's fucking eye.
Tell Ken to put his hands down for Christ's sake."
"Oh, fucking God."
Gately can feel his eyes crossing and uncrossing by themselves.
"He's soaking right through it, man. Look at that shit.
This man needs an ambulance."
Somebody else, female, says "God" again, and Gately's hearing warbles a bit as Joelle snaps at her to shut up. She leans down and in, so Gately can see up at what looks like a regular, human, female chin and makeupless lower lip under the veil's billowing hem.
"Whom should we call?"
she asks him.
"Call Pat's machine and Calvin. You have to dial 9. Tell him to come down."
"I'm going to be sick." "Her daddy!"
Minty is shouting at Ken E.
"Tell her to call Annie and the EM office down there and do some, like, strategic thing."
"Where the fuck is security when it isn't just innocent recovering cars to get towed?"
"And call Pat," Gately says.
A forest of footwear and bare feet and shins all around him, and heads too high to see. Lentz screaming back to somebody in the house,
"Call a fucking ambulance already! Regulate the voice, man! Fucking call about 5 ambulances is more like it! Motherfucker!"
"Shh!
I was never saw anything like that."
"Nuh-uh,"
Gately gasps, trying to rise, and deciding he just likes it better lying down.
"Don't call one for me."
"This is a straight and narrow."
"By those it bide."
"He doesn't want one," he said.
Green's in Minty's boots, treats purple plastic shower thongs. Somebody has on Clearasil he can smell.
Seen some ratchet ass kickings in my past, brother, but...
Somebody male screams back off to the right.
Just don't try and walk me around.
Gately grins up.
Dipshit! He can't go in no ER with a gunshot!
Minty says to Lintz, whose shoes keep moving to get himself north of everybody.
Somebody turn off the car, will you?
I wouldn't touch nothing.
Gately focuses at where the Joelle girl's eyes would be. Her thighs are forked way wide to straddle his arm, which is numb and doesn't feel like his. She's bearing down on him. She smells strange, but good. She's got all her weight on her bathrobe's pad. She weighs roughly nothing. The first threads of pain are starting to radiate out of the shoulder and down the side and into the neck. Gately hasn't looked down at the shoulder on purpose, and he tries to wedge his left hand's finger under the shoulder to see if anything went through. The night's so clear, the stars shine right through people's heads.
Green.
I'm touch-adaptive. Don't worry.
Look at his head. Her kimono's shoulders are humped and glassy black in the Montego's light. Gately's brain keeps wanting to go away inside himself. When you start to feel deeply cold, that's shock and blood loss. Gately sort of wills himself to stay right here, looks over past Joelle's hand at Lentz's fine shoes.
Lentz, you and Green, get me inside.
Green!
The circle of stars, heads, faces above are all faceless from the headlight shadows. Some car engines have shut off, and some haven't. One of the cars has a twittering fan belt. Somebody suggesting to call the genuine finest, or daddy, which everybody greets with scorn at his naivete. Gately's figuring staff from the shed, or number four has called them, or at least dialed down to security. By the time he was 10, only his pinky finger would fit in the dialer's holes of his mother's old princess phone. He exerts will to uncross his eyes and stay right here. He, in the worst way, does not want to be lying here with a gunshot in shock, trying to deal with the finest.
I think one of these guys is, like, expired.
No shit, Shylock!
Nobody call!
Gately yells it up and out. He's afraid he's going to vomit when they stand him up.
Nobody call nobody till you get me in!
He can smell Green's leather jacket overhead. Bits of grass and whatnot drifting down onto him from where Lance is still brushing off his clothes, and coins of blood on the street from Green's nose. Joelle tells Lance if he doesn't cut something out, she's going to hand him his ass. Gately's whole right side has gone deadly cold. To Joelle, he says,
I'm supervised. I'll go to jail, sure.
You got fucking eyewitnesses out the ass behind you, Don Man.
Either McDade or Glenn says, but it can't be Glenn. For some reason he tries to bring up inside him. And it seems like Charlotte T's voice saying Ewell's trying to get in Pat's office to call, but Gately locked Pat's door.
Nobody call anyone!
Joelle shouts up and out. She smells good.
They're calling! Get him off the phone! Say, prank, for Christ's sake! You hear me?
Her kimono smells good. Her voice has a staff-like authority. The scene out here has changed. Gately's down. Madame Psychosis is in charge.
We're going to get him up, and we're going to get him inside, she says to the circle. Lentz.
There's impending static crackle and the sound of a serious set of keys. Her voice is that one Madam Lady's voice on No Subscription Radio. From out of nowhere, he's all of a sudden sure. It's where he heard that odd, empty, half-accented voice before.
Security! Hold it right there!
It's at least luckily one of the ex-football EM security guys that spends half his shift down at the Life and then goes up and down the streetlet all night playing with his service baton and singing sea shanties off-key. That's just impressively qualified to come in to AA with them. Joelle.
Odetti, deal with him.
Pardon me?
It's the drunk,
Gately gets out. Joelle's looking up at presumably Ken E.
Go over and look high income and respectable at him. Verbalize at him. Distract him while we get him inside before the real ones come.
How am I supposed to explain all these prone figures draped over cars?
For Christ's sake, Ken, he's not a mental titan. Distract him with something shiny or something. Get your thumb out of your ass and move.
Gately's smile has reached his eyes.
Your madam on the FM is how I knew you.
Erdetti's squeaky shoe and the obese guy's radio and keys.
Who hold it? As in desist?
Security, I said halt!
Green and Lentz bending in, white breath all over and Green's dripping nose the same copper smell as Lentz.
I know you,
Gately says to Joel, whose veil remains inscrutable.
If I could ask you to specify halt from what?
Get his back up here first, Green tells Lentz.
Not crazy about all this blood, Lentz is saying. Many hands slide under his back. The shoulder blooms with colorless fire. The sky looks so 3D you could, like, dive in. The stars distend and sprout spikes. Joelle's warm legs shift with her weight to keep pressure on the pad. The squishing sound Gately knows means the robe's soaked through. You want somebody to congratulate him for not having thrown up. You can tell some of the stars are nearer, and some far down there. What Gately's always thought of as the big question mark is really the Big Dipper.
I'm ordering desist until who's in charge and I can report the situation.
The security guy's hammered. His name's Sidney, or Stanley, and he wears a security hat and baton shopping in the Purity Supreme, and always asks Gately how it's hanging. His shoe's uppers are blasted along the feet's insides, the way fat men that have to walk a lot are. His ex-ball player's collops and big hanging gut are one of Gately's great motivators for nightly sit-ups. Gately turns his head to throw up a little on both Green and Joel, who both ignore it.
Sorry. Shit, I hate that.
Joel V.D. runs a hand down Gately's wet arm that leaves a warm wake, the hand, and then gently squeezes as much of the wrist as she can get her hand around.
And lo, she says softly.
Jesus, his leg's all bloody, too.
Boy, do I know guys love that show you did.
A tiny bit more throwing up.
Now we're going to lift him very gently and get the feet under.
Here, Green Man, get over there on the south, why don't you? I'm ordering the whole situation. Halt it right there where you are.
Lance and Green's shoes coming together and moving apart at either side of Gately, faces coming down in a fisheye lens, lifting.
Ready?
Year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. Interlace Tell Entertainment, 932/1864, RISC Power TPs, with or without console, Pink Sub 2, Post Prime Star DSS Dissemination, Menus and Icons, Pixel Free Internet Fax, Tri and Quad Modems with Adjustable Baud, Post-Web Dissemination Grids, Screen So High Def You Might As Well Be There, Cost-Effective Videophonic Conferencing, Internal Frox CD-ROM Electronic Couture, All-in-One Consoles, You Shit You Ceramic Nanoprocessors, Laser Chromatography, Virtual Capable Media Cards, Fiber Optic Pulse, Digital Encoding, Killer Apps. Carpal Neuralgia, Phosphenic Migraine, Gluteal Hyperadiposity, Lumbar Stressy. Half of all Metro Bostonians now work at home via some digital link. 50% of all public education disseminated through accredited encoded pulses, absorbable at home on couches. Miastonic Kondo's immensely popular exercise program spontaneously disseminated daily in all three ON-AN time zones at 0700 hours, a combination of low-impact aerobics, Canadian Air Force calisthenics, and what might be termed cosmetic psychology. Upwards of 60 million North Americans daily kicking and genuflecting with Tony Kondo. A mass choreography somewhat similar to those compulsory AM Tai Chi slow-mo exercise assemblies in post-Mao China, except that the Chinese assemble publicly together. One-third of those 50% of Metro Bostonians who still leave home to work
could work at home if they wished. And, get this, 94% of all ONANite paid entertainment now absorbed at home, pulses, storage cartridges, digital displays, domestic decor, an entertainment market of sofas and eyes. Saying this is bad is like saying traffic is bad, or healthcare surtaxes, or the hazards of annular fusion. Nobody but luditic, granola-crunching freaks would call bad what no one can imagine being without. But, so, very much private watching of customized screens behind drawn curtains in the dreamy familiarity of home. A floating no-space world of personal spectation. Whole new millennial era, under Gentle and Lace Forchet. Total freedom, privacy, choice. Hence, the new millennium's passion for standing live witness to things. A whole sub rosa schedule of public spectation opportunities. Spect ops. The priceless chance to be part of a live crowd watching. Thus, the gapers blocks at traffic accidents. Sewer gas explosions, muggings, purse snatchings, the occasional Empire WDV with an incomplete vector splatting into North Shore suburbs and planned communities, and people leaving their front doors agape in their rush to get out and mill around and spectate at the circle of impacted waste drawing sober and studious crowds, milling in rings around the impact, earnestly comparing mental notes on just what it is they all see. Hence the apotheosis and intricate pecking order of Boston street musicians, the best of whom now commute to work in foreign autos. The nightly chance to crank back the drapes and face out into the streets at 00:00 hours, when all street-parked vehicles have to switch sides and everyone goes nuts and mills either switching or watching. Street fights. Supermarket checkout confrontations. Tax auctions. Speeders stop for ticketing. Coprolaliac Touretters on downtown corners. All drawing liquid crowds. The fellowship and anonymous communion of being part of a watching crowd. A mass of eyes all not at home. All out in the world and pointed the same way. Which, see the crowd-controlled headaches at crime scenes, fires, demonstrations, rallies, marches, displays of Canadian insurgency. Crowds brought together now so quickly, too quickly even to see them. A kind of visual inversion of watching something melt. The crowds collect and are held tight by an almost seemingly nucleic force. Watching. Together. Almost anything can do it. Street vendors are back. Homeless vets and twisted figures in wheelchairs with hand-lettered signs outlining entitlement. Jugglers, freaks, magicians, mimes, charismatic preachers with portable PAs. Hardcore panhandlers stem like they're selling nostrums to small crowds. The best panhandling now verges on stand-up comedy and is rewarded by watching crowds. Cultists in saffron with much percussion and laser jet leaflets. Even some old-style Euro beggars, black-browed persons in striped leggings, mute and aloof. Even local candidates, activists, advocates, and grassroots aides have returned full circle to the public stump. The bunting-hung platform, the dumpster lid, vehicles' roofs, awnings, anything overhead, anything raised to a crowd-collecting public view. People climb and acclaim, drawing crowds. One top Back Bay public spectop every November is watching expressionless men in federal white and municipal cadet blue drain and scrub the public garden's man-made duck pond for the upcoming winter. They drain it sometime in November every year. It's publicly unannounced. There's no fixed schedule. Long, shiny trucks just all of a sudden appear in a ring at pond's rim. It's always a weekday, circa mid-November. It's also always somehow a gray, raw, sad, windy Boston day. Gulls cartwheeling in a sky the color of dirty glass. People mufflered and with new gloves on.
Not your ideal Sylvan-type day for conventional lounging or public spectation. But a massive crowd always collects and thickens in a dense ring along the banks of the public garden's pond. The pond has ducks. The pond is perfectly round, its surface roughened to elephant skin by the wind, geometrically round and banked with lawn-quality grass and shrubbery in even-spaced clumps, with park-type benches between the shrubs, overhung by white-barked willows who've now wept their yellow autumn grit onto the green benches and grass banks, where an arc of crowd now forms and thickens, watching duly designated authorities commence to drain the pond. Some of the pond's flightier ducks have already decamped for points south, and more leave on some phylogenetic queue just as the shiny trucks pull up, but the main herd remains. Two private planes fly in lazy ellipses just under the cloud cover overhead, banners strung out behind them advertising four different levels of comfort and protection from depend. The wind keeps blowing the banners sideways, Mobiusizing them, and then straightening them back out with a loud pop of flags unfurling. From the ground, the engines and banners' pops are too faint to hear above the crowd noise, and ducks and wind's mean whistle. The swirling ground winds so bad that U.S. Chief of Unspecified Services Rodney Tyne, standing with his hands at the small of his back, at a window on the 8th floor of the State House Annex on Beacon and Joy Streets, looking southwest and down at the concentric rings of pond and crowd and trucks, can see wind-driven leaves and street grit swirling right outside and pecking at this very window he stands before, massaging his coccyx. Dr. James O. Incandenza, filmmaker and almost a scopophile about spectops and crowds, never once missed this spectacle when alive and in town. Hal and Mario have both been to a few. So have several Ennett residents, though some of them weren't in much of a position to remember. It seems as if everyone in Metro Boston's seen at least one pond draining. It's always the same sort of grim, windy, northeast November day where, if you were at home, you'd be eating earth-toned soups in a warm kitchen, listening to the wind, and glad of home and hearth. Every year himself came was the same. The deciduous trees were always skeletal, the pines palsied, the willows wind-whipped and nubbly, the grass dun and crunchy underfoot. The water rats always seeing the big drainage picture first, and gliding like night to the cement sides to flee. Always a crowd in thickening rings, always rollerblades on the garden's paths, lovers joined at the hand, frisbee in the distance on the rim of the garden's other side's hillside's slope, which faces away from the pond. U.S. Office of Unspecified Services Chief Rodney Tyne stands at the unclean window for much of the morning, ruminative. His posture, a marshal at ease. A stenographer and an aide and a deputy mayor and the director of the Massachusetts Division for Substance Abuse Services and Unspecified Services Regional Operatives Rodney Tyne Jr.
257
and Hugh Steepley
258
all sit silently in the conference room behind him. The stenographer's Greg pen poised in mid-dictation. The 8th-floor window's purview goes all the way to the ridge of the hillside at the garden's other end. Two frisbees and what looks like a disemboweled ring of frisbee float back and forth along this ridge, dreamily floating back and forth, sometimes dipping below the ridge and lost for a moment to the specular vision of Tyne. Trying at the same time to give his bad skin some quality UV and a good chills chap, the grad work-study engineer of MIT's WYYY-109 lies bare-chested on a silvery NASA souvenir space blanket, supine, and cruciform, at about the angle of a living room recliner on the public garden's far hillside. This is out by Arlington Street, in the garden's southwest corner, hidden by its ridge from the pond's basin, and tourism booth, and pavilion, and the hub of radial paths, and the giant verdigrised statues of ducklings in a row, commemorating Robert McCloskey's beloved and timeless Make Way for Ducklings. The garden's only other slope is now the bowl of the former pond. The hillside's grassy decline, not too steep,
runs at a wedge's angle down toward Arlington Street and is one broad greensward, free of dog droppings because dogs won't go to the bathroom on inclined terrain. Frisbees float on the ridge behind the engineer's head, and four lithe boys on the ridge play a game with a small beanbaggy ball and bare blue feet. It is 5 degrees Celsius. The sun has the attenuated autumn quality of seeming to be behind several panes of glass. The wind is bitter and keeps flopping unmoored sections of NASA blanket over parts of the engineer's body. Goose pimples and real pimples jostle each other for space on his exposed flesh. The student engineer's is the hillside's only metallic space blanket and bare torso. He lies there, splayed, wholly open to the weak sun. The WYYY student engineer is one of roughly 3 dozen human forms scattered over the steep slope, a human collection without pattern or cohesion or anything to bind them, looking rather like firewood before it's been gathered. Wind-bronzed sooty men in zipperless parkas and mismatched shoes, some of the garden's permanent residents, sleeping or in stupors of various origin. Curled on their sides, knees drawn up, unopen to anything. In other words, huddled. From the great height of one of Arlington Street's office buildings, the forms look like things dumped onto the hillside from a great height. An overhead veteran would be apt to see a post-battle battlefield aspect to the array of forms. Except for the WYYY engineer, all the men are textured in urban scuzz, unshaven, yellow-fingered, and exposure-bronzed. They have coats and bedrolls for blankets, and old twine-handle shopping bags, and glad bags for recyclable cans and bottles. Also, huge camper's packs without any color to them. Their clothes and appurtenances are the same color as the men, in other words. A few have steel supermarket carts, filled with possessions and wedged by their owners' bodies against a downhill roll. One of the cart owners has vomited in his sleep, and the vomit has assumed a lava-like course toward the huddled form of another man curled just downhill. One of the shopping carts, from upscale Bread and Circus, has an ingeniously convenient little calculator on its handlebar, designed to let shoppers subtotal their groceries as they select them. The men have sepia nails, and all somehow look toothless, whether they have teeth or not. Every so often a frisbee lands among them. The loose ball makes a beanbaggy sound against players' feet above and behind them. Two skinny and knit-capped boys descend very close to the engineer, chanting very softly, "Smoke?" ignoring all the other forms, which anyone could tell are undercapitalized, for purchasing smoke. When his eyes are open, he's the only one on the hillside to see the round bellies of ascending ducks pass low overhead, catching a thermal off the hillside, and rising to wheel away left, due south. His WYYY-109 t-shirt, and inhaler, and glasses, and M-Fizzy, and spine-split copy of Metallurgy of Annular Isotopes are just off the edge of the reflecting blanket. His torso is pale and ribby, his chest covered with tough little buttons of acne scar. The hillside's grass is still pretty viable. One or two of the scattered fetal forms have black cans of burnt-out sterno beside them. Bits of the hillside are reflected in Arlington storefronts and office windows and the glass of passing cars. An unexceptional white Dodge or Chevy-type van pulls out of Arlington's traffic and does some pretty impressive parallel parking along the curb at the hillside's bottom. A man in an ancient NATO surplus wool greatcoat is up on his hands and knees to the engineer's lower left, throwing up. Bits of chyme hang from his mouth and refuse to detach. There's little bloody threads in it. His hunched form looks somehow canine on the uneven slope. The fetal figure wedged unconscious under the front wheels of the shopping cart nearest the engineer has only one shoe, and that shoe's without laces. The exposed sock is ash-colored. Besides the handicapped license plate, the only exceptional things about the van, now idling at the curb far below, are the tinted windows,
and the fact that the van is spotless and twinkly with wax to about halfway up its paneled side. But above that line, dirty, and rust-saucered, and shamefully neglected-looking. The engineer has been turning his head this way and that, trying to tan evenly along his whole jawline. The curbside van idles at a distant little point between his heels. Some of the hillside's forms have curled themselves around bottles and pipes. A smell comes off them, rich and agricultural. The student engineer doesn't usually try to sun and chap his skin at the same time, but chapping ops have lately been scarce, since Madame Psychosis of 60 minutes more or less took her sudden leave of medical absence. The student engineer hasn't once had the heart to sit out on the union's convoluted roof and monitor the substitute shows. The engineer moves his upturned face back and forth. First, Madam was replaced by a mass comm graduate student who proved a crushing disappointment as a misdiagnosis. Then Madam was publicly deemed irreplaceable by management, and the engineer was now paid simply to cue her background music and then sit monitoring a live mic for a noiseless 60 minutes, which means he has to stay in his booth maintaining zero levels with a live mic and can't ascend with his receiver and cigarettes, even if he wanted to. The station's student manager's given the engineer written instructions on just what to say when people phone in during the hour to inquire and wish Psychosis a speedy recovery from whatever might ail her. At once denying and encouraging rumors of suicide, institutionalization, spiritual crisis, silent retreat, pilgrimage to the snow-capped east. The disappearance of someone who's been only a voice is somehow worse instead of better. A terrible silence now, weeknights. A different silence altogether from the radio silence-type silence that used to take up over half her nightly show. Silence of presence versus silence of absence, maybe. The silences on the tapes are the worst. Some listeners have actually come in and down through the deep cortex and into the cold pink studio itself to inquire. Some to allay this firm conviction that Madam was still showing up and sitting there by the mic, not saying anything. Another of the men sleeping nearby keeps punching at the air in his sleep. Almost all the personal wee hour inquiries were from listeners somehow bent, misshapen, speech defective, vacantly grinning, damaged in some way. The type whose spectacles have been repaired with electrician's tape. Shyly inquiring, apologies for bothering someone they can clearly see is not even there. Before the student manager's written instructions, the student engineer had wordlessly directed their attention to Madam's triptych screen with no silhouette behind it. Another white Dodge van, just as unevenly clean and opaque windowed, has appeared on the ridge above and behind the hillside's littered forms. It casts no visible shadow. A frisbee ring caroms off the clean grill of its snout. It idles, its panel door facing the declivity, and the other white van's panel door far below. One hideous little inquirer had had a hat with a lens on it, and seemed about to fall forward into the engineer's lap, his attendant wanting some address where they might send something supportive and floral. The NASA blanket's micronized aluminoid coating is designed to refract every possible UV ray into the student engineer's bare skin. The engineer knows about the ambulance, and the Brigham and women's ICU, and five-day rehab ward from the thick, swart girl Notkin, the one with the disreputable hat and film department ID, who came down via the Basler elevator late at night to retrieve some old tapes of the program for the madam's personal listening use, she said, and was fortunate enough to know the madam in private life, she said. The term is treatment. Madam Psychosis is in long-term treatment at something the bearded girl in the sooty hat obliquely described as only half a house in some unbelievably unpleasant and low-rent part of the metro area. This is the precise total of what the WYYY engineer knows. He is shortly to have occasion to wish he knew a great deal more. which see the dimpled steel ramp now protruding from the squeakily opened panel door of the van on the ridge above and behind him, which see the utter darkness inside the idling van down along the Arlington Street curb, whose side panels also been slid open from within. The southwest hillside is copless. The garden's platoon of MDC finest are all in their souped-up golf carts over at the drained pond, throwing curved sections of glazed donut into the ducks' shrubbery and telling a largely dispersed already crowd to please move along. The ridge's frisbees and hacky sackers have abruptly vanished. There's now an eerie stillness like a reef when a shark cruises through. The ridge's van's idling maw, open and black, silver-tongued. Which see also the wheelchair that now all of a sudden shoots down the hillside's van's ramp as a madly squeaking brass-colored blur. A snowplow-like scoop-type thing welded to it, and out front, skimming the ground and throwing off chaff from the swath of grass it's mowing, moving terrifically fast, brakes unapplied, the legless figure up on burly stumps in the chair, fleur-de-lis with sword-stem masked and bent far forward for a skier's pure speed, the huddled, fetal hillside figures, the speeding chair slaloms, the dim, glittered movements of arrangement for reception deep within the curbside van way at the bottom of the steep grade. The engineer, arching his neck way out to capture sun on the scarred hollows under his jaw. The shopping cart with the calculator clipped by a squeaking rubberized wheel at an angle and sent clattering off down the hillside, spraying possessions, the homeless shoe to which it had been roped, skittering empty behind it, and the cart's now shoeless, unconscious owner just waving at the air in front of his face in sleep, as if at a bad DT dream of lost shoe and worldly goods. The calculating cart, whumping into the side of the hunched man vomiting and flipping over and bouncing several times, and the vomiting man rolling and yelping, vulgarities echoing. The WYYY engineer, now to be seen hiking himself up on a chill-reddened elbow with a start, and starting to turn and look above and behind him up at the ridge, just as the speeding wheelchair with a hunched figure reaches him, and the chair's shovel scoops the engineer and his NASA blanket and shirt and book up, and runs over the glasses and bottle of M-Fizzy with one wheel, and bears the engineer in the scoop up and away and down the steep grade toward the idling van at the bottom, a van whose own angled ramp now slides out like a tongue or autoteller's transaction receipt, the NASA blanket blowing away from the scooped engineer's flailing form about halfway down, and suddenly aloft in the hillside thermal and blown far out over Arlington Street traffic by the keen November wind. The madly squeaking wheelchair aloft over hillside moguls and coming back down and up again. The snatched engineer in the chair's scoop appearing to the hillside's roused figures, mostly as an hallucinatory waggle of bare limbs and strangely wheezy shrieks for help, or at least a look out below. All as the modified chair squeaks frantically straight down the hillside's most efficient downward line toward the van with the ramp now idling in gear, its pipes exhaust beating the street in high RPM idle, the NASA blanket twisting coruscant in the air high above the street, and the shriek roused figures on the hillside lying there still bent in and barely moving, stiff with cold and general woe, except for the hunched man, the unwell man, who'd been hit by the dislodged cart, who's rolled to a stop and is thrashing, holding the parts that were hit. The 11th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. 18-10 hours. 133 kids and 13 assorted staff sitting down at supper time. The ETA dining hall taking most of the first floor of West House, a sort of airy atrium-like commons, broad and knotty pine-paneled, the east wall hugely fenestrated, and columns running the length of the room at center, with ceiling fans high overhead circulating the rich and slightly sour smell of bulk-prepared food, the oceanic sound of 20 different tables' conversation, the flat clink of utensils on plates, much chewing, the clank and tinkle of the dishwasher's conveyor belt behind the tray bus window, with its sign saying, "Your mother does not live here. Bus your tray." the muffled shouts of kitchen workers and steam. The top upperclassmen get the best table, an unspoken tradition. The one nearest the gas fireplace in winter, and the AC venting in July. The one whose chair's legs are all pretty much even, both seats and backs, with thin corduroy cushions in ETA red and gray. The prorectors have their own permanent table near the carbs bar. The Syrian satelliter, an enormous peasant-skirted moment soft profiler, are with them. The players can all do some very serious eating. Some of them still in sweaty sweats, with salt-stiff hair, too hungry after 3 set PMs to shower before refueling. Co-ed tables are quietly discouraged. The boys' 18s and the cream of the 16s are all at the best table. Ortho, the Darkness Stice, ETA's 16s A1, has just this PM gone 3 sets with Hal and Condensa, 17, ETA's second-best overall boy, taking Hal all the way to 7-5 in the third in an off-record, non-challenge, exhibition-ish engagement Stitt had them play out on the West Courts that afternoon for reasons no one has yet pinned down. The match's audience had grown steadily as other challenges got done and people came up from the weight room and showers. News that Stice had very nearly beaten an ink nobody but John Wayne has been able to beat has made its figure eight way around the tables and serving line and salad bar, and lots of younger kids keep looking at the best table, and Stice, 16, crew-cutted, and still in his black Fila sweats with no shirt under the unzipped top, assembling a complex sandwich on his plate. And they let their eyes widen, and postures sag to communicate awe. R-H-I-P. Stice, oblivious, bites into a sandwich like it's the wrist of an assailant. The only sound at the table for the first few minutes is a fork work and mastication and the slight gasping sounds of people trying to breathe while they eat. You rarely speak for the first few minutes here, eating. Supper is deadly serious. Some of the kids even start in on their trays while still in line at the milk dispenser. Now, Coyle bites in. Wayne has made his entree into a sandwich and lowers and bites. Keith Freer's eyes are half-closed as his jaw muscles bulge and slacken. Some of the players' inclined heads are hard to see over the height of their food. Struck and shocked, side by side.